being forced to make a decision on the spot before you move on forces you to really think, is this what I want? Rather than, okay, it sounds kind of cool, let's just keep going. And that there's a lot of power in that mindset. You're going to make different decisions, better decisions.
This is the Self-Recording Band Podcast, the show where we help you make exciting records on your own, wherever you are, DIY style. Let's go. Hello and welcome to the Self-Recording Band Podcast. I am your host, Benedikt Hein, and I'm here with my friend and co-host, Malcolm Owen Flood. How are you?
Hello. I'm great, man. How are you?
I'm great as well. Thank you. I've been working in Pro Tools for the first time in years today.
And yes, I was going to ask how that's going.
Yeah, I was expecting a lot of things to go wrong, but it all went surprisingly well and smooth. So that's a good thing.
Awesome.
It's a little challenge here. I try to leave my comfort zone every now and again, and I agree to do this project and work from the Pro Tools session instead of my usual like Cubase setup and everything. And I'm not even planning on exporting the tracks. So it's not a matter of like just making it convenient for the client, but I want to work out of the actual Pro Tools session in this case and see what they used, plugins and instruments and all that. They baked a lot of stuff in there, and that's why we wanted to do that way. I don't take on those projects usually. But in this case, the song was so great and I wanted a challenge. And now we'll see how it goes.
Awesome. Yeah, good song goes a long way.
Yeah, exactly. So what's new at your end?
Good question. I'm on my like cup of coffee in the morning. So I was like, not ready for that one. I can't think back. I'm on the Monday reset here. So whatever happened last week is gone already.
Okay.
It's been good. Some mixing and mastering stuff going on for me all week, and then some TV work stuff on the horizon that I can't really talk about yet, but I will be sharing soon enough.
Cool. Can't wait.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so then let's talk about today's episode, I guess. And this one is, again, about gear, at least. Yeah, it is about gear, basically, and how to use it, or if you should use it. And because of that, I want to give you something. And this is, I call it the Essential Gear Guide. It's a PDF. It's a free thing that you can download. If you go to the selfrecordingband.com/gear guide, you can download that PDF, and it tells you what gear you really need and how to decide what you really need. And yeah, it's just a free guide to get you started and save you a bunch and help you save a bunch of money. And it's like, I think, the perfect thing to go along with this episode, because what we're going to talk about today is, should I record through EQ and compression? Should I buy gear to do that? Is it worth buying gear, buying hardware, or using plugins on the way in? So is it worth committing to certain types of effects, certain types of processing during the recording? Or should I just record raw recordings, not process them in any way, and just have leave all the options for later for the mix? That's the question we're going to answer today. And one part of that question is, of course, for those people who don't already own hardware or plugins to do that with, is should I buy those things? So that's just part of the question. If you are like most people at home with a laptop and an interface, and you're wondering about like if you should buy a cheap compressor or something, that's what we're going to talk about today.
Yes. Essentially, when to use them and if they're necessary, summing it up.
Exactly. Totally. Absolutely.
Right.
So what does that even mean? Because I just struggle to explain this, because there are many different ways to actually do that. What does EQing or compressing on the way in? What does that mean typically?
Right. Okay. I picture it as sculpting. So you do your best to choose the right mic and place it and all that. You know, you're capturing the instrument as you normally would, and then you get into the control room and you're listening back, and it's not quite what you were hoping for. Especially in context. That's when that's a good point I think we should make, is that often the decision to process with EQ or compression is after you hear it sitting with other instruments that are already tracked, and you realize that it needs to gel a little bit better. That's often when I would grab either an EQ or compressor, or both, often both, and then try and shape it so that it does fit that context and kind of gel into what I'm doing. So EQ, everybody knows what EQ is, but we're just changing the frequency response and how bright or dark it is kind of thing, stuff like that, you know, going after pokey frequencies or whatever. Most people start with a digital EQ these days, almost everybody. So, and a digital EQ can do some really crazy things that you don't even realize are really crazy, like make really tiny narrow cuts and sweep around as you listen and stuff like that. Hardware compressors don't work like that generally. So it's a much more broad thing, unless you have some really crazy hardware tools, I guess, but usually it's very broad. Whereas compressors generally work similar to the DAW compressors. Different, but similar. So there are more types of hardware than EQ and compression, but those are like the two main ones. So that's what we're talking about today. Did that answer the question?
Yes, totally. And one thing to add is that we are talking about using those things while you are recording. So you're committing to the sound of those. So it's not like inserting an EQ on the channel so that you can still bypass it after the recording's done. But we're talking about having those things in the recording chain. So your microphone, your mic pre, and then the hardware compressor or EQ, and then the converter, and then it goes to the computer. Or you, if you don't use hardware, you just record as usual. But between the DAW, the track on your DAW where you capture it, and the input, there is a plugin that you record through and that you are printing through. So you're committing the sound of that plugin, and it gets recorded and baked into your track that you're recording. So either way, it's using EQ or compression on the track that you're recording in a way that you can't undo it. So
right.
Yeah. That's the distinction here.
Yeah. So I think that's where we kind of need to start this conversation is, why would you do that? What's the purpose of committing, right? And we have talked about that on other episodes, but it's something that you owe, like, it's a big mind shit. Wow. Just said shit.
Did you just say a big mind shit? Can we please leave that in? So yeah, what about the mind shit?
Another sip of coffee before I say shit again.
Yeah.
It's a big mindset shift. especially if you're not used to that. And when you're coming up in the world of recording now, you are used to having this unlimited flexibility of taking things on and off and experimenting. So it is a thing to get used to, committing on the way in, and you can't go back because it's now gone. It is done. And I think in most cases, it should be done. You should be committing on the way in if you can. And we will be talking about people that don't have hardware and what they should be doing as well. But if you have the option and it's the right tool and it's doing what you want, then 100% I would commit. I have a universal audio interface, which does what Benny was just talking about, where you can record through plugins, and I use it all the time. It's all, like, anytime I'm tracking something, there's usually something on there because I've found some tools on there that I like, and I know how to get results from them pretty quick. And it's just, it, like, if it makes the sound, like what I'm recording sound more like what I'm imagining in my head, it's like, yeah, it's done. It's on there. I'm not going to think twice about it.
Yeah, totally. Cool. We're going to talk about specific, like, recommended tools and example scenarios later. So the universal audio interfaces are one option. So we're going to go back to that later. For now, I think, as always, there won't be a final answer. What I can say right now. Like, it depends. Totally depends. But we're gonna go through some scenarios, and we're trying to help you figure out if it's worth it in your case. I think the question that Malcolm just asked, so why would you do that? Why do I want to do that at all? That's the basically the most important question, and I think I agree with what Malcolm said. I think you should do it if that's how you get what you are hearing in your head, if that's the way to get the sound that you're going for, unless there's any other way to achieve that sound. So if there is a way to achieve it at the source, or if to fix a problem without EQ or compression, then I would always try that first. But if the only way to get to the desired result is to use an EQ or compressor on the way in, I would absolutely commit to it. And we're going to talk about why we actually want you to commit to it rather than just inserting it and leaving it for later. There's a difference here. It's all about the mindset shift that Malcolm was talking about. And if you can at all solve it at the source, you should do that first. So I just want to say that, because sometimes it's not a matter of shaping things or using the box tone, the specific character of a piece of gear or something. Sometimes it's just about fixing a problem, and that should usually be done, like, or you should at least try to do that before you insert any EQ or compressor or something like that. Oftentimes moving the mic or changing the mic or doing something to your room acoustics or like using different strings or drum heads or whatever is the better way to solve a problem. So
Yeah, that's a great point. Often on instruments, less so on vocals, but like pretty well any other instrument, hardware is really just being used to enhance and not correct in my situation. It's not a correction tool generally. It's more of an enhancement and just like subtle, get it a little bit closer to, like I said, to fitting into context with everything else that's already down. But I'm not like, there's a really weird pokey resonance in the snare. I'm going to go suck that entirely out with a piece of hardware. I'm probably not going to go do that. We're going to go try and tune the snare, change the skin, try and change the snare, or get the drummer hitting it differently.
Totally. And it's also about, I think, part of using those types of processors, like EQs and compressors, is just to add a certain flavor or character to the recording, because it might be, you might be able to achieve that later with a simple digital EQ or something, but if you commit to it, if you use a certain piece of gear, they all sound different. Even if it's not the most high-end best piece of gear, it will sound unique. It's just something that is in the recording. It's a certain character that you can't get rid of anymore, and it's just something to recording unique, cool signals. So I think oftentimes it's more like these subtle things, this character thing and the shaping, more than like surgical correction and fixing stuff. Yeah, but one thing that you said that's interesting to me, and you're totally right, is the exception are vocals, basically. Because you can't change strings or skins. You can't change vocal cords. So you can make your singer sing a little differently. You can position the mic differently. You can choose a different mic, of course. You can choose a position in the room. But your options are kind of limited here compared to a drum kit. So at some point, EQ and compression is like inevitable. You need to do something in most scenarios. And if you know what you're doing and if you have a clear vision in your head, a clear goal that you want to achieve, then why not commit on the way in? It's often a good idea.
Yes. Yeah. That being forced to make a decision on the spot before you move on forces you to really think, is this what I want? Rather than, okay, it sounds kind of cool, let's just keep going and we'll, you know, obviously we'll come back to that. But this is it. Is it exactly what I want? And that there's a lot of power in that mindset. You're going to make different decisions, better decisions.
Absolutely. And if you don't need to worry about certain things because they've already been done and there's no, like, you cannot change them, it just frees up so much like brain RAM. You can't just, like, you don't have to worry about those things because there's no point. You can't undo it. It's just there. So let's move on. And the more options you leave for later, the more confused it's going to be a mess at some point, and you're going to forget about things that you actually wanted to do later, but you end up not doing them because it's just too much. And I like just getting one thing done and then moving on to the next. So there's an advantage. But of course, it's risky. You can also like really damage things. You can cause harm if done wrong. So we need to say that there's a risk, of course, especially if you're new and you're still experimenting. You can ruin your recordings. You can ruin a great take if like you choose the wrong piece of gear and use it incorrectly. So there's that. And that's why you need to find out if it's worth it or not. And we try to come up with some ways to find out whether it's worth it for you or not. And the first one would be the performance. So does the thing you choose and the way you choose it, you use it, does that affect your performance? So the classic example for me, it's not really a piece of like outboard gear, like EQ or compression, but just to explain what I mean here, if you're playing the guitar and you're playing through a delay pedal, that delay will probably change the way you're playing and interacting with the amp. That delay can become part of the performance depending on how you set it, but there are certain parts that you can only play with that delay pedal. So leaving that out of the chain and trying to do that later will probably change the way you play and will therefore be like, it will be necessary for your performance to record through that pedal. That's, I think, a classic example. But the same thing can be true for a vocal change. If the singer just sounds differently and feels differently, if they feel more confident, and if they just like how their voice sounds on their headphones, and the only way to achieve that is with that recording chain, and you can't really do that in the monitoring chain, then yeah, do it. If that makes the performance better, if that makes the performer feel better, go for it.
There's a lot to unpack there, but you might not even realize that it's making a difference in how they perform or you perform. But compression can be really great for that, especially with vocalists, I think. It just kind of can really can solidify their vocal and add some confidence factor. And then what happens is people also start playing into that compression, right? Like drummers start kind of pushing into the compressor, like, and hitting their snare a little differently. And you can kind of change their performance by twisting the knobs around. I mean, that takes practice and helps if you're recording somebody else, because if you're twisting knobs for yourself, it's kind of hard to go like back and forth. But it does make a difference. You know, it's the same reason that I like to throw reverb on a channel for the vocalist. Just, you know, like, you're in it, you know? You've got like some reverb and delay. You feel like a rock star. You're going to sing differently. Not everybody likes that, but I always want to offer that.
Yeah, totally.
So it totally affects your performance. And as long as that's affecting it in a good way, then totally worth it.
But then again, you just said like the reverb and delay thing. That's usually almost always done on the like listening side of things, on the monitoring side. So you don't record through the reverb or the delay usually, but you put it on the send and you just blend it with the monitoring signal, what they're hearing. So you're not committing. And with the EQ and compression, you could do both. You could, depending on your setup and what you have, you could record through a vocal chain and then that's what you record. Or you could put a plugin on the track and you just listened through that chain, but you can bypass it afterwards. That's not committing. That's just listening to that. It can achieve the same effect for your performance, but it's not committing. So the second question here is, after like, does it affect your performance? The second question is, do you have to commit, or can you just do it on the monitoring side, the headphone signal, like with the reverb or delay? And I'm curious, like, when do you choose to commit, and when do you choose to just put a plugin on the channel and just listen through it, but not printing it?
Right. So whenever possible, my EQ and compression is committed. But I get, it really depends on what instrument, I guess. But like you said, reverb and delay on a vocal, I'm almost never going to record that. It's just too, you need to tweak that stuff. It takes too long, essentially, is really the problem, because you need the rest of the mix to be finished before you can dial that stuff in.
Yeah, and you want it on a separate channel, so you don't want
it. I want it on a separate channel, all of this stuff, yeah. But EQ and compression, generally, you can go right for it and just get it done then and there. I mean, what you have to realize is, even though we are committing this stuff on the way in, is we're normally doing more later as well.
Yes.
Right? It's really just getting it as close and far as we can at that moment. And then we're going to take it even further later on in the mixing stage. But we need it to be the right like shape and color for right now, kind of thing, so that it fits in the picture we're painting. And then we can, you know, do the finer details later.
Hey friend, this is Benedict from theselfrecordingband.com, and if you are producing your own songs, I have a question for you. Do you ever listen to your music and feel like something is just off? Maybe the drums sound weak, or the guitar tone bothers you, maybe the vocals don't really cut through the mix, or the whole thing just doesn't sound finished and professional, but you can't really put your finger on it? I know you want to release big, punchy, professional sounding songs, right? The type of authentic, unique art that connects with your audience on a deep level. But you're just not sure what's missing with your recordings. Somehow you just can't connect all the dots. And I get it, the amount of things to learn and all the conflicting information out there can be really overwhelming. Especially if you're a lone wolf trying to figure it all out on your own, right? Now here's the good news. Whether you've been self-recording for years, or you're just setting up your first home studio, I want to offer you my personal one-on-one help. As long as you are determined to put in the work, I'm offering a limited amount of free one-on-one coaching calls with me. On this hour-long call, we'll dive deep into your recordings and create a personalized roadmap for you to finally solve the issues you're struggling with, so that you can release music that you'll be proud of forever. If you are ready to see and believe
that it's actually possible to achieve your goals and make the records you've always wanted to make, then go to theselfrecordingband.com/call and apply for one of my limited coaching spots. I can assure you that making exciting and successful DIY records is very doable. We've done it, lots of other people have done it, you can do it as well. Talk soon. theselfrecordingband.com/call.
I don't think that there is actually a big difference because, and here's why, because if you just put it on the channel and not commit it, it's still there, and the decisions you're making after that to all the other things you were going to record will be based on how that channel sounds with those plugins. So you will make your decisions based on that anyway. So you can't just deactivate it later usually because that has influenced your other tracks and the way you record the whole thing. And then when you export everything and send it to a mixer, and then before you do that, you deactivate all the plugins and everything you've used in the session, it will be a totally different production. It will be a different thing. So you want to print those probably and send that to your mixer because you want them to take the project where it is and like keep the things that you came up with and just improve it. And if you don't do that, if you take everything off in the end, it will just fall apart, basically, depending on how much you did. So I think there isn't too much of a difference. The only difference it really makes is you're saving processing power and like on your computer and in your brain because you don't have to think about it anymore. So unless it's something really risky and really like a drastic thing that you're not sure about, I would commit things. If it's really drastic and you don't know what you're doing, that's an important distinction, of course. I would always ask the mixer first. Just in case, or I would send two versions maybe, because there are, of course, advanced techniques and things that someone new to this or like a self-recording band or artist who's not a professional mixer, they might not be sure about what they're doing, and that's totally normal and fine. And if that's the case, just do two versions. But if you like what you're hearing and if it's not too drastic, I would just commit because it doesn't make a difference really to me.
Yeah, I think my one pushback to that is that even with the plugins there and you're moving forward and listening to that, moving forward, I think just knowing that you can go back kind of changes that point of that you're willing to say, okay, I'm good to move on. Where if you're committing, you have, like, you really just have to be sure that you're not going to tweak anymore and start recording.
Yeah.
I think there's like this little bit of like, you just know you have that extra room to make a mistake and you just, you might just move forward without committing like to the sound entirely, which isn't the worst thing in the world. I mean, it's not. It's fine. I got that Slate mic a while back. I think we talked about that when I got that mic, and it uses emulation to model different microphones. And I can't record hardware through that if I want to hit that mic emulation first. So I'm kind of having to do this with vocals these days, and it's working out fine. It's a combination of like committing for the sake of. I mean, part of me is like, well, that's the job of being a recording engineer is making things sound a certain way. So, like, come on, that's what we got to do. But then there's also, like, do we have the tools? You know, just because there's a piece of hardware doesn't mean it's the right one. So you might, like, you know, the plugin might do a better job a lot of the time. And time, because we've talked about session flow before, but it is so important. And if you're killing the session's flow, trying to dial in hardware for the sake of experimenting or just fiddling knobs, it's not worth it. And you should just, I think, grab a plugin and move. Does that make sense?
Totally true. It just depends on if you commit through that, like if you commit that plugin or if you just leave it on and then with the option to deactivate it.
Right.
But totally true. And I mean, I'm kind of, I was thinking about doing that episode, I was kind of unsure if it's a good idea because it's, on the one hand, it's a question that many people have and that I got asked in the community as well, more than once. On the other hand, so I think it's important to talk about that, but on the other hand, I knew that our recommendation would be to at least try, or like we would encourage people to commit, but that's so dangerous sometimes. So I was not sure if that's actually good advice because you can totally ruin stuff. And it's hard to draw the line, or it's hard to, you need to know for yourself, basically, if you know what you're doing and if you trust your instinct and what you're hearing, if your monitoring is good enough to even judge that. So there's a part of it is just you being like realistic and honest to yourself. And like, yeah, and I mean, yeah, it's difficult because I can see scenarios where someone really digs a certain piece of gear or a certain setting, and then once you hear it in a on a good monitoring system, and once it gets compressed more during mixing and it gets refined, things might come up that aren't as pretty or that you don't want to be in there, like especially saturation, distortion, subtle artifacts that you might miss in your environment. So that there is a danger. There is definitely a danger. But still, right. I think it's worth it. It's the same mantra that we've been that we had in a couple of episodes. Like sometimes you just need to make bold decisions, and it's sometimes it could mean that you fail and have to do it again, but it could be worth it. So
yeah, I think there's two camps to answer that problem. There's the camp that's just trying to that really wants a good album at the end of this, and they're hiring a great mixer like Benny to finish it. Those people should probably err on the side of caution. And just do play it safe through this, you know, like do what we're saying and try and have a vision and, you know, keep those plugins on. So you're making decisions and hopefully can commit those and give a wet and a dry to Benny or whatever. But you're ultimately just trying to get through this and have a great product. But if you're the kind of person who is trying to become a great audio engineer and you want to be improving at this, you got to start committing and make those mistakes. Honestly, it's like the only way to learn what you can get away with is by doing it. Like I said, EQ and compression are just getting used all the time by me on the way in committing. Vocal distortion, not so much. I throw it on all the time because it's like fun to track through and I love that stuff, but I'm probably going to want to get a little more tweaky in the mix. So I don't really commit that stuff. And you know, you just kind of learn what you can do and can't do based on experience.
Yeah, exactly. Also, if you're in the first camp, like if you just want to have a great product in the end, and you're more like a musician looking to get the best possible production, and your goal is not to become the best recording or mixing engineer or whatever, then you can still commit because sometimes that makes things more exciting. But then you're probably in this case hiring a mixer anyways or other people, experienced people, and you should just talk to them and maybe they can help you make those decisions. Like when you're in pre-pro and deciding on tones or when you're in the actual recording session, most good mixers or people that you're working with will be willing to like have a quick call with you or answer an email or like help you decide on like whether you should use a certain piece of gear or a certain setting or not. So in this situation, I would just have a conversation with them. Some people will like it if you send them raw tracks and they will not want you to do anything risky. And other people will love it if you are just being bold and trying crazy stuff. So have a conversation with them. It really helps.
Yes.
Yeah, and exactly. And if you're doing it all on your own or, as Malcolm said, if you're just trying to improve as a recording engineer, make as many mistakes as possible because that's the fastest way to learn, basically. So, yeah.
There's a lot of good to be said about having practice sessions where you're not trying to record the song that you really care about and it matters if you get it right or wrong. But record something that's just like a demo idea that nobody's going to hear, you know? Like, it's just for internal band use, like pre-production stuff. That's where you can try and do this stuff and really get good at it.
Yeah. Yeah, so the next question, and that's what Malcolm just said when you said like with vocal distortion, you like to tweak things afterwards. The question is, can it be done afterwards in the mix easily or even better? Or is it something you absolutely have to do right now? Because like, yeah, there's no way to do that later. A scenario like this could be if you like want to record something really crazy with some weird piece of gear that only you have or some. Like you want to abuse something to create a cool effect, you need to do that now. Like no one else will have that piece of gear. If you want to have that on the record, you need to record it. So
yeah. I mean, in like the indie folk pop rock kind of thing that's kind of popular with like Chris Stapleton or Mumford and Sons, yeah, that of kind of stuff, you know, that Chris Stapleton's not really in that, but there's a lot of like stomp clap based songs, you know, and they're like really roomy and distorted and saturated kind of thing, and the song's based around that. So if you didn't have that really sounding the right way as you're tracking the song, like it'd be really hard to record the other instruments to it, right? So I feel like some stuff has to be done on the front end. Like there's no way of building, like the song is based around that, So you have to go that route, right?
Yeah, true.
But then there's other things like where the claps are just there to supplement the snare, and you just have your bedroom studio or whatever, then just record some dry, lame sounding claps and, you know, then jump into plug-in land and tweak away. And, you know, the mixer can do some cool stuff with it later. It'll be fine.
Yes, totally. And I can think of many scenarios where people send me stuff and then, like, raw stuff. And then they're like, in this part, we want you to create this type of effect. And then they try to explain the crazy effect that they are envisioning for that part. And I'm always like, why didn't you just try and record that? You know, like, that's the, those are the kind of scenarios where they want something unique, something different. So there's no right or wrong here anyway. So just if that's what you want to do for a certain part or transition, or like even if it's just a standard thing like a lo-fi effect, we've been talking about that a lot, like the radio or telephone effect stuff, just find a pedal or a plugin or a piece of gear that can do that and print it and commit to it, because it will be your unique telephone effect. And if you just tell the mixer to do that, depending on who they are, they might just do something generic that they always do when someone wants a telephone effect or a radio effect. But if you are creating that effect, it's yours. And there can't you can't do much harm here, I think, with stuff like that, because it's unique anyways. So if you want to do something special like that, just do it. Just have fun, experiment, and send that to the mixer.
Yeah. One little bit of culture I want to influence and change is that if you want vocal echoes, like dedicated, like echoes that are like, you know, like really intentional ones, not just like any delay that's through the whole song or whatever, but actual echoes, send that to your mixer. Don't tell them you want echoes on certain words and have like a bunch of 40 notes at different times. That is just the worst thing.
Yeah.
Like, and you know they had it in their session, they just didn't send it. So yeah, you send that. Commit a delay or some people like to record the delay, so it's a fake delay. You know, it's actually them singing the delay track. And that sounds really awesome sometimes. You can do that. Whatever, you know, whatever gets the job done. But send that along. And then, you know, maybe the mixer will recreate it the way they want, but they'll have an example track. It'll save everybody a lot of time.
Yeah, totally. I 100% agree. Yeah, do that. So yeah.
Off topic, but.
Sorry, what's that?
A little off topic, but it's about committing.
Yeah, but it's about committing. So it's totally like, yeah, absolutely worth mentioning.
So we should circle this back to hardware. And if you need it, because when people think committing, they think hardware. Even though there are, like we said, some tools that let you record through plugins. But hardware is the big thing. And that's the big attractive, sexy thing that everybody wants. And they imagine their studios being lined with it at some point. I mean, I wanted that until I found out how much hydro those big walls of gear take. I was like, oh my God, that'd bankrupt me.
Yeah.
But anyways, it is fun. They're really, you know, rewarding to use. They look great in the rack. I love my 1073 in front of me here. I'm not even using it, by the way, but it's there. I don't use it for the podcast. And so, yeah, we all like gear, but do we need it? Is it a good thing to spend our money on? That is something we want to address, because like Benny said, people ask about that stuff a lot. So when is it a good idea to buy gear?
I think...
Where to begin?
I think it's... The question is, what else could you do with that money? What, like, does your budget allow to do that without compromising anything that's more important? So I think it's never a good idea to purchase anything for that reason, for that purpose, if there are other more important things that you need to take care of first. And that's basically everything. So on the hierarchy, on the gear hierarchy, if you want to make a list like this, it would be the least important thing, unless it's something that can't be achieved in a different way. So if it's some character thing, some unique, weird, whatever effects thing, and that's the only piece of gear that can do that, of course you have to buy it if you want to record it. That's true. But if it's just, quote unquote, just EQ or compression, then the question really is, have you done everything else? Have you improved everything else? Because everything else is more important, in fact. And that's... It hurts sometimes because we think we can fix our recordings and mixes by just buying a nice fancy piece of gear, but usually we can't. So if you save money on strings and drum skins and sticks and cymbals and setting up your instruments well, and using the right instruments, improving your room, all that, if you're trying to save money here in order to buy a fancy EQ, a compressor, probably not a good idea.
Yeah, I 100% agree. It's like you said, it's really the least important thing. These things are just meant to help shape what we're putting into them. So they are not the result. Garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah, yeah. Especially because most people, most home studio owners or DIY recording people, self-recording bands, they don't start buying the best high-end gear that would actually make a difference at a very high price point, but it would make a difference. They are often starting with like budget, sometimes consumer gear or cheap Chinese clones of stuff that sometimes are good, sometimes not so much. Or they just buy the cheapest hardware compressor they can find just because they think hardware is always better. And especially then, it doesn't really make sense or it doesn't really move the needle or make things better. So, yeah, I think that plugins have come such a long way and are so good these days that you need to have a really, really good reason to buy hardware and not just use the plugins you have or the plugins that you can buy for cheap and record through those if you want to commit and compress an EQ on the way in, because we're going to talk about that you absolutely can do that. So you will need a pretty damn good reason to buy hardware instead of just using the plugins. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's there's not a lot of reason to. I thought that I would never really be interested in going into a studio that didn't have a compressor, just really for the purpose of vocals. Because I think vocals are pretty hard to get a good recording if you're not using compression.
Yeah.
But like I said, I got that Slate mic and I have to use plugins now to pull that off. And it's been fine. It works great. Like I said, I have to kind of still make sure I am committing and dialing in the sound before we move on. Sorry. But it totally works. And I would say that most plugins these days are better than cheap hardware gear. Like, it's gotten good. The DAW plugins are not holding you back. Don't think that they are.
Absolutely. I think below a certain threshold of the quality of hardware gear, don't even think about it. Like, the typical question is, and I don't want to bash any like company or something or anything like that here, but I have to say that one of the most typical question is that people see some modern DBX compressor or something online that's meant to be used for live sound most of the time, I guess, or it's entry-level gear that it can be fine live if using an analog small mixing desk or whatever. But they see this compressor online for, I don't know, $200 or something, and they wonder if they should buy that because they think it's a hardware compressor and it's better than the plugin. And it's probably not. If you are having, like, if you have good emulations of 1176s, LA-2As, all the studio standards, and if you have the modern current emulations of those, they will probably be better than any of those cheap hardware compressors, totally. And the same goes for EQ. Any like UA, Pultec, or any of the, whatever you have, like all those emulations, they will sound better than a cheap EQ on your, whatever you have, like small rehearsal room console or whatever. Those EQs won't sound as great as the plugins.
I really think that hardware is something that really only needs to exist in like functioning recording studios. It's not really something that I would suggest for any home studio setup, unless you plan to have other people in there and turn it into a business. In which case, you know, they're tools, but still low on the totem pole of things you need. But for DIY production, where you often have like a small track count interface, you know, if you're programming drums and stuff, whatever, and you just have a couple channels on your interface, then it's not really worth going down that road. And like we said, that what else could you spend that money on? And the list is very, very long.
Yes, totally.
You know, so wouldn't recommend investing in that too much. But the topic, a lot or half the topic, this is kind of a dual episode.
Yeah.
is like when to compress and when to use that stuff on the way in. And the answer is, if you have it, then maybe. Yes, go for it. But if you don't, like, pretty much it's just, to sum it up, what we recommend is kind of obvious, but it's use the tools you have to the best of their ability and your ability and master them.
Yes.
So if you only have plugins, it's not about finding gear that you like. It is about mastering those tools, mastering those plugins, and making them the tools you like, because they will do the job. You just have to figure them out.
Yeah.
There's a, in Pro Tools, Benny, which you're now in, the stock de-esser is pretty good. And I just like, I mean, it like it's super dumb. It's not a smart, intelligent plugin, but it really works. And I just like went shopping around. I've got like four different de-essers, and now I just keep going back to the free one I had in the beginning. If only I had not wasted a bunch of time trying to find other de-essers and use the free one. You know, so what is that? What's GAS stand for again?
Gear acquisition syndrome. Is
yeah, that? Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's a real thing. And it also exists, we should mention, in plugin form as well. It's not just people wanting to buy hardware or other guitar pedals and stuff. It also is software.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. So yeah, Malcolm just summed it up. Like, there's two reasons. One is you have checked all the boxes and the only thing left to do to improve is to get hardware, great hardware, and you record through that. So that's one reason. Pretty unlikely. The other reason would be, if you're just doing it because you want to learn and it because it excites you, mm-hmm. it's fun to do. And that's a valid reason. I mean, it doesn't make yeah. your recordings better, technically. But if you have more fun using those things, if you find yourself making more music just because you have that, like those knobs in front of you, then that might actually be worth it. Depends on who you are. I can do just fine with a laptop and still be creative. But there are people who just make more music and spend more time on their in their studio if there is an EQ or a compressor that they can tweak. And if that's the case, like that's a good reason, actually. But I would start with a certain level of gear. Like, I would maybe start at like the where the warm audio pieces are or something like that. You don't have to go for the very fancy stuff, but at least get something close to the originals, to the classic stuff. I would get maybe an 1176 clone. There are some DIY kits out there that you can build. There are the warm audio stuff. I can't really talk about the Clark stuff as much because I have used one 1176. I didn't like it that much, but might just be me. A lot of people seem to love them.
I know people that do like it. I haven't used one, but I know people I trust who do get good results from it. Exactly. I've used the Audioscape stuff, which is a similar price range, and I think it's pretty great.
Yeah.
The stuff's out there for, I mean, I think that Audioscape stuff's like only like $400 or $500 Canadian or something for a compressor. Yeah. So that's pretty reasonable.
Do your research and get one of the clones that are used, that are like widely used and that people really like. And don't fall for some, I don't know, Chinese copy that just looks like the real thing, but no one's ever used it and you find it for cheap on some weird website. Don't buy that. But there are a couple of pieces that are cheap or at least affordable that a lot of people, a lot of trustworthy people love and use, and start with those. That's where I would start. I wouldn't buy any of the really cheap like live sound gear stuff. I would start with the classics. I would go for an opto compressor, maybe something like an 1176, and then maybe a Pultec clone or some of the like those classic pieces, because they will help you learn compression and correct EQing. They will help you get an understanding for what the box tone is of those things, what the basic character is. And it's just fun to tweak those. So if you would really want to do that and it helps you and it inspires you, then start there, I'd say.
Yeah. So I feel like we need to do a recap here.
Totally.
Our topics are all over the place. We're saying do commit, but using whatever tools you have available and master those tools. We're also saying you don't need to buy hardware, but we're definitely not saying that, like, we don't want to be an anti-gear page. We're not really that, you know? Like, if you get a new piece of gear and it's cool, post it in the Facebook community, we're going to be stoked. You know, we're not going to be like, shame.
Yeah,
exactly. Should have bought guitar strings, you know? Like, that's not what we're getting at. Like, gear is fun. It is cool. I like it. I am investing in a ton of location film audio gear right now. And I mean, nobody finds that stuff cool other than me, but like, it's fun for me. I'm building a kit and it's like, yes, this is awesome. So, you know, you can still do this, but we just want it to be, you know, when you're doing a podcast, it's hard not to be like, well, it's this versus doing this, but that's not the case. Obviously, you can do both. You can get good at your plugins and still get gear or whatever. We're just trying to put it into perspective what the priorities are and really highlight that EQ and compressors and other hardware gear is not the way to good records. That is not a shortcut.
Yeah, agreed. And you know what's funny? When we started this episode, I was asking you if you think there will be a solution or a conclusion, and we said probably not because it depends. People will need to find out for themselves. But I think there is some sort of solution now, or one thing that we recommend. And I think that's the plugin workflow. Because the more I think about it, that's kind of the middle ground. And that's where I would really start. Because not committing at all, we don't recommend that. Buying hardware, we don't recommend that as well, unless you want to have fun and you want to just learn. But using plugins, and first maybe starting to use them to just monitor through them, to get a feel for them, and then starting to commit those plugins, that's, I think, the way to go. That's the best of both worlds, actually. So you don't need to buy expensive hardware. You can start with your stock plugins. You can eventually upgrade and buy plugins with it, which is usually cheaper than hardware. You can still commit, so you have that benefit. I think the plugin route really is the way to go, actually.
It does make sense, yeah. And just so we're clear, there are plugins that you can track through and like that won't add latency or noticeable latency. And then there's plugins that you can't, and they really slow, like you'd hear it, and that you won't be able to make a good performance with that. So you'll learn. That's another thing you need to know, is like what plugins are available in your tracking toolkit.
Totally. So let's talk about some example scenarios and some recommended tools before we wrap it up. You started with the UAD plugin. Like the beginning of this episode, you mentioned your UAD plugins and your UA audio interfaces, the Apollo.
Yeah. I mean, they're on the expensive side of brands, but it's really great. You can't really go wrong with any of their products. Even their kind of lower models are awesome. Yeah. So definitely recommend it. And with that stuff, you can record through the plugins. Like the plugins can be treated as if they're a piece of hardware in the chain. And I really love that. No complaints there. Would highly recommend them. But they're definitely not essential. There's other brands that are great.
Yeah, cool. The way I do it is I don't have a UAD interface. I have a UAD card. Like I can use the plugins, but I don't have the interface. Mm. So what I do is I use Cubase. And in Cubase, you have input tracks. So you do not only have audio tracks, but input tracks. And those have inserts as well. And if you insert a plugin on an input track, if you make the input tracks visible and you insert a plugin there, then whatever plugin you put there, you will record through it and it will be printed. So you can't disable it later.
Oh. What? That is a really cool feature, Cubase.
Yeah, totally. It's so rad. So you have all the basic audio tracks, just as in every other DAW, but then there's a category of tracks which is called input tracks. They are invisible by default, I think, but you can make them visible. And yeah, it's just they have their own fader, their own inserts. If you move the fader, yep, that will also affect the gain.
Right.
Whatever you
do to
the tracks.
So that lets you record the UA stuff, but you could also record any plugin.
Exactly, any plugin. Huh. But the UA stuff doesn't really work because it all adds latency because of the external processing, I think, and stuff. Right. So I don't. I might be wrong, but I think you're gonna have latency issues.
Gotcha.
But with every plugin that has low enough latency with your buffer settings and everything, like every plugin that's just fast enough to pull that off, you can insert there and record through it. Or you can do it with any plugin, but some plugins will be suitable because of the low latency and others not so much.
Right, yeah.
But it's a really great thing. And you can, of course, use all the stock things. They don't have, they don't produce much latency. So the stock EQ that's on every channel and stuff, you can obviously use that. It's a pretty cool feature. It's basically like those input tracks are like the console in the UA interface.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You can do that with any DAW, by the way. It's just not set up to be easy like that in other DAWs. Like Pro Tools, you'd have to set the output of the track you're recording onto into another one and, you know, or use an aux. Yeah, it'd be kind of complicated and time consuming.
Yeah.
So it's just not really part of the workflow. So that's really cool.
Yeah, totally. So you can do that. Then there is things like the other products like the Universal Audio interfaces. There are the Antelope interfaces, I think. They have their own modeled plugins. I can't say anything about those. I have an Antelope converter, but I don't use it as an interface, and I have no idea how the plugins sound. I just know that it's a similar workflow, and you can record through the Antelope plugins. So, yeah. And there is more brands like that. So, basically, you either do it in your DAW, or you buy an interface with plugins and, like, some virtual mixer that allows you to use those plugins as just like you would with hardware.
Yeah. So, it's kind of a hybrid system, which is pretty great. And then, of course, there's just using plugins and just running them on the channel. Like we said, with as long as the latency doesn't add up, you can record through them fine. And there's something to be said for mixing a little as you go, you know, like with those plugins, you know, the drum mix is always getting tweaked every time I open up the session a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit better. And it's just honing the vision that little bit. Totally. So that's another nice touch of plugins for sure.
Totally. Yeah. What are some example scenarios? Like not that the gear, we covered that, but some scenarios where you think doing that will actually be beneficial or could be a good idea. We already talked about the vocal thing, the compression in the vocals that just makes it feel better. What else is there?
Like examples of when EQ and compression are great. Like I said, I feel like throwing a compressor on like a snare can really change how the drummer starts hitting it and get them digging into it a little bit more. Obviously, guitar is a big one. Again, compression, people just play into compression. It changes how you play. There's like a kind of elastic bandy thing going on that you can really dial in somebody's dynamics with some clever compression and try and shape that a little bit. But tone as well, I think. You know, we've even talked about like changing the volume of what they're listening to make them play harder and stuff like that. It all is that kind of idea. Is that what they're hearing impacts their hands or whatever instrument a little bit.
Yeah, totally. A classic thing for me is bass, the consistency. Similar as with vocals, I just like to limit the dynamic range a little bit with bass. I like more consistency. I like some more of the mid-range grit and like character that we get from compression. And so bass is a classic thing. I almost always record through compression when I record bass. Mm. Same as with vocals. And then there's some sort of corrective EQing, even though we recommend it not to do a lot of fixing with gear, but there's still some sort of corrective EQ that I like to do on the way in. So for example, with toms, no matter how well I tune them and no matter how like the drum skin I choose, and even if all of that is perfect, there's still going to be some 400, 500 hertz, like mid-range mud or cardboard sound that I want to get rid of. And I almost always grab an EQ and pull that out right during recording because it instantly sounds better.
Yeah. And people, so sounding better is kind of this weird objective word to use, but it's what we mean by that is that it sounds good enough that they're not being distracted by how anything sounds.
Yes.
It just like, they hit the tom, they're like, that's sweet, I sound like a rock star, and just keep on going. Whereas if it's like boxy and weird sounding and flappy, they're going to be like, okay, like, I wonder if we should change this. And then they don't mention it for four takes, and then they end up tuning it while you're like, no. Yeah. But you getting stuff to sound good and pretty much you just don't want the performer to be thinking about how it sounds, because if it sounds good, you've done your job. They only notice when it sounds bad.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But even like that kind of EQ, what you're talking about, is still kind of like broad strokes shaping. You know, you're like, okay, big cut here kind of thing. It's not like going finding whistles and attacking that kind of stuff at that point.
No, it's done in a matter of like seconds now for me. I just grab an EQ, pull out some lower mid-range, and they don't sound like cardboard anymore. So same thing with kicks, by the way. Not so much the getting rid of stuff, but if I do heavy music, and I do that a lot, then the amount of beater attack and click that I get from the microphones is usually not enough, even with very bright, very clicky microphones and placement and stuff. So usually I'll just grab a high shelf, just a very broad thing, and just boost some highs with the kick inside mic, just to get more, because drummers want to hear that. They want to hear their attack. They want to hear the precise click sound, and it just sounds more finished. And usually if you're doing metal or any sort of heavy modern rock music, you probably want to do some boosting here. You don't have to go too crazy during recording, but just a high shelf with a couple of dB just makes it better.
Make sure that that's clear and defined and in focus.
Yeah.
Yeah, would agree.
So those things. And then also low cuts sometimes, or just getting rid of rumble. Sometimes that can be also done with a shelf or something. But for some signals, some instruments, you don't need a lot of subs or like low end. And I just get rid of that right away because it distracts me. And yeah, stuff like that. Broad strokes, sometimes yeah. removing stuff, sometimes adding stuff. But if I clearly feel like there needs that like I need to do something because it's not sounding the way it's supposed to sound, I just do it.
Yes. Yeah. It's funny. A lot, everything we mentioned in the last 5 minutes there can easily be done with a plugin. We've kind of been convincing ourselves as we've been recording this episode that like just more and more outboard gear is really unessential.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. It's totally unessential. It's like completely unessential, actually. It depends on who you are. If it helps you make better record for whatever reason, then it's worth having it. Yeah. But it is not technically necessary. It's just, depends on who you are.
I started this conversation very pro hardware in that it forces you to commit, but that's really what I care about is the committing part, and that you can do that with plugins, no problem. So it's just the mindset of hardware just needs to be brought over to the digital DAW.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so I mean, it's kind of a confusing episode, but at the same time, this is really what this is about. This is what we've expected, so it's no clear answer. There's the recommendation to try and commit to things, to try and start with plugins, but there's no clear answer here. And that's kind of the answer we wanted to give you, because if you're asking, do I have to buy hardware because in an effort to make my records better? No, you don't. Do I have to compress an EQ on the way in? You don't have to, but it might be worth it. Mm-hmm. So there is an answer, but not a clear one. Depends on your situation.
Yes. Yeah. I would say probably you do, but how you do it is what we've discovered.
Exactly.
Doesn't matter as much. You know, like it doesn't have to be analog, can be digital, doesn't even have to be printed. It could be just sitting there, but you want to just be making a decision. Like I said, being an audio engineer is making things sound a certain way. So that's what we're encouraging.
Yeah.
Make it sound the way you want.
Yes.
Using whatever tools you need to.
Exactly. You could probably do all those things with whatever you have right now. And you should only start spending money if you've maxed out on like things you can do with whatever you have.
Yeah. You've got buckets of money and you want some toys. There you go.
Exactly. Exactly. Which is perfectly fine. I mean, but yeah, just know that it's not necessary to get better records. All right. Yeah. That's it. If you have, as always, if you have any more questions, if you're thinking about buying a specific piece of gear, and you want some feedback, some input on that, or if you're running into a specific problem and you think gear or EQing or compressing on the way in might solve it, just ask and we'll try to help. And do that in the community, the selfrecordingband.com/community. That will forward you to the Facebook group, which is free. You can just join it, start a conversation there. And I hope this episode is helpful. Download the gear guide along with it. It's like more structured than this episode is, but it's also just a gear guide. A lot of additional info in here, I think, in this episode. Yeah, that's all I have to say.
Yeah, there's definitely stuff to take away from in there. So I hope you liked it, and we will of course see you next week.
Exactly. Bye. Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Hey friend, thanks again for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this one, just know that this is just a tiny fraction, a small taste of what we can actually do to help you completely transform your recordings and mixes forever. If you are really serious about your music, if you want to reach your goals as a self-recording artist, then please apply now for the Self-Recording Syndicate, our coaching program that takes you from where you are to being able to completely independently produce and release exciting sounding music forever. If you join that program, you're going to be part of a very, very passionate, dedicated, committed group of self-recording artists from all around the world, and you're going to get a roadmap, guidance, feedback, personal access to me and the team. We're going to do everything, literally everything we can to help you make the best recordings you can possibly make. And it all starts with a free first call, completely free, no strings attached. Best case scenario, we're going to end up working together and we're going to completely transform the way your music sounds.
Worst case scenario, you're going to get an hour of free coaching and an action plan that you can then take and implement on your own. So if that sounds interesting to you, get started now with your first completely free call by going to theselfrecordingband.com/call or just click the link in the show notes. See you next week.